minister to us this morning, human beings unable to really handle the spirit factor apart from your help. We ask for that at this time in Christ's name, amen. We virtually or essentially finished Revelation last week. So what we're going to do is take a look at some of the verses in chapter 22 that we went over rather hastily because it was my purpose to sort of give you an overall view of the ending of the book. But there are some verses here that are important. In verse 16, Jesus said, I, Jesus, sent my angel to witness these things to you upon the churches. I am the root and the generation of David, Genos, the offspring of David, the brilliant morning star, which of course is actually Venus. And if you look up in the sky and you see this early in the morning, you see a bright star, if there's really Venus. And but Christ is called the brilliant morning star, probably with a reference to the resurrection factor of life. But the word genos I passed over lightly last week, but let me remind you once again that in the Gospels you have the very enigmatic statement, this generation shall not pass away till all these things be fulfilled. Well, some people on the basis of that statement have accused Jesus of being overly optimistic or of having a mistaken notion of his identity. There are those who believe that Jesus was sort of megalomaniac in terms of his, or we might say, we use the word today, messianic complex, by which we mean somebody who feels that they are the new Messiah or something like that. We've had them around, and or in the 20s you had a character by the name of Father Divine who thought that he was God incarnate on the earth, and so there are people who thought Jesus had that kind of feeling about it. The interesting point to remember as far as the messianic nature of Jesus, apart from the record, you see, the record could be, by a stretch of the imagination, it might be said that his disciples had a different view of Jesus and his work than Jesus himself did. Because Jesus himself did claim to be the Messiah. Now, the event in history that forever identifies the claim of Jesus to Messiahship as a serious claim was the crucifixion. That's why the Jews crucified him, because he claimed to be God and thus blasphemed. Now keep that always in your mind, because one of the strong arguments by the non-believer is that Jesus did not actually claim this for himself, but his disciples claimed it for him later. Well, remember, that's why the Jews crucified him. And they didn't crucify him for anything against Herod, but rather because he claimed to be a Messiah and he blasphemed against God in their mind. Here where it says Jesus is of the root and genos of David is the same word that is used for generation. The root of it is generation, G-E-N. In fact, our own English word, G-E-N, generation, comes from that. A genetic, generation, progeny, all those words come from this word. And so its overall meaning has to do with progeny, which by which we mean those that are given birth to, progeny rather than a period of time. It is used on occasion for a period of time, but not normally. And this, and there's no problem with Jesus' statement if you look at it in this way. And the amazing thing is, as I said, the persistence of the people of Israel, because, you see, Israel Today, the name Israel belongs to a nation. It is made up of Jewish population. As much as Israel has been spread, or the Jewish people have been spread around the world, and as much as there has been intermarriage, and as much as there has been religious apostasy, they still hang together as a people for some reason. Now, racially, they're Semitic. Like all of the, or the basic population of the Middle East is Semitic. The Arabs are Semitic, for example. They're brothers under the skin, you see. They did not, up until 47, they did not have a nation. And yet, there were Germans that were still regarded as Jews. And yet they belong nationally to Germany. There are Russians that are Jews. There are French that are Jews. There are English people that are Jews. So they belong to many different nations. And yet still that separateness remains. A Jew is still a Jew. But what is a Jew? He's a Semite, but so is an Arab. He has a religious origin, but many have left that. There are few today among the Jewish populations that are really Orthodox. I've explained that to you before. That is, that really care much about God or pay any attention to Him at all. The major population of Israel today is non-theistic. We easily speak of Jews, because we have the whole biblical antecedents of that. You see, we've been taught about Jews in the church ever since we ever became a part of it. The Jewish idea is rooted in the church. But outside of that, where it comes easy to us, few people stop to ask, what is a Jew? They don't realize what the meaning of Jewish is, because they've just had a general attitude toward it. But if you take away the religion, if you find them intermarried, if you were to take away the national entity, take away the racial distinctive, what have you got left? What is a Jew? Now, according to the scripture, God knows what is a Jew. And in these passages, like Matthew 24, where it says two will be grinding at the mill, one will be taken, the other left, and so on, I have rarely heard, I don't think I've ever heard it said this way, but it is true, that we're not talking about Christian and non-Christian. That passage does not have to do with the rapture. That has to do with the bringing of the Jewish population back to Israel. And where there's been intermarriage, one will be taken, the other left. You have a Gentile and a Jew together, there's going to be a recovery of the Jewish people. Now, that may be literal and it may only be figurative, but you're not dealing there with Christian and non-Christian. But especially if you've got two shall be grinding at the mill. Now, that's a little more easy to handle, but two grinding the mill, two men working side by side, or women. One is a Jew and the other's not a Jew. One's going to be taken away and the other left. Now, all of that happens in the 24th chapter of Israel, of Matthew, at the time when. Now, how do we get a time fix on the 24th of Matthew? We get a time fix when it says, this is that which was spoken of in Daniel the prophet, that when the abomination of desolation shall stand in the holy place. That means you have to have a temple in Jerusalem. And you have to have a point at which the temple is being desecrated, because that's where Jesus identifies it. You read over the chapter, I'm not going to read it today. But there's a time when the Jewish people will be regathered from the four corners of the earth, according to the text. Now, how precise that is, I don't know, but it's going to be noticeable and general as far as Jewish people are concerned. And so I'm saying God knows what a Jew is, even if we don't. The reason I'm telling you these things, you get people coming through the media giving you all kinds of wild notions about prophecy. And if you're not instructed, you're going to be confused at the least and drawn off at the most. Not that it will de-Christianize you to understand what a Jew is or not understand what a Jew is, but it'll get you drawn into camps that are heretical in nature. For example, the Jehovah's Witnesses that are heretical in nature. You can be drawn into that camp by false understanding of prophecy, and several others that I won't take the time to mention now. So I want you to be cool about this. When all these wild things are being said from a prophetic base, and understand more or less where we're at. Jesus was of the root and genos, the progeny, offspring of David. So Jesus came through natural human processes into the earthly realm, and he became a human. But I'm not sure that you could find a more important concept about life than this, which we have been trying to get across to you, that life on the earth is to be viewed as a gauntlet. I want to fix it in your minds, and because that will help you to handle the great inequities that are around us today. Why do some suffer so intensely, others seem not to suffer? Why is one house left standing and others burnt down? Why, you see? Why are some babies taken and some not? You know, just equity or fairness exists only in the spirit realm. I did not say equality because that's a very fuzzy term, but equity exists, evenness exists only in the spirit realm. Outside the spirit realm is the earthly gauntlet. I want you to make peace with that word and with that concept, because it represents our course on the earth. And to start with the premise, if we become Christians, Christ will make a good life for us is totally off base. I want you to realize this. Then you will have peace in the midst of your tribulations. And Jesus says that. John 16:33. These things have I spoken unto you, that in me you might have peace. In the world you will have tribulation. The word is affliction, and its root meaning is pressure. The world is a pressure cooker. It gets more and more that way as time goes on. And the only strength is fortification in the spirit, where it doesn't matter out here what happens on the earthly scene, so long as you are walking shoulder to shoulder with Christ. Christ is, or himself, went through the gauntlet of earth. He did not come to do anything to correct the world situation. We're in a pressure cooker here. And there are people vying for your minds, and people vying more particularly for your dollars or for your allegiance, your membership. People always have to have memberships. And you can send in your money and get a little gold card that says you're a member of this or that group. Big deal. The world is in this chaotic condition. Now here is Jesus in the midst of the poverty and want of the Middle Eastern area, and his whole activity, the entire activity of Jesus relative to the poor, or rather relative to hunger or feeding, was in the feeding of 5,000, perhaps 15,000, who were not essentially the poverty stricken. It is not likely if a person is lying as a beggar in the streets of Jerusalem, he's going to trek out to Galilee and listen to Jesus preaching. Not likely. Or he's going to trek out even from, what, Nazareth or Capernaum or any place like that. It'd be quite a walk from there. But the people were people who had the opportunity to go out there and listen to him. Now, he fed these people. More importantly, he fed them miraculously. He didn't set up a soup kitchen. In one stroke, Jesus fed 15,000. Now, you tell me how long it would take you to set up an organization and feed 15,000 people. Logistically, it would be a big task. You'd work from dawn till dark trying to get them fed, even if you had the food already brought in by catering trucks, which they didn't have in those days. Given every human, modern, mechanical device for handling this problem, you would still take a whole day trying to feed him. So obviously, that event is not an example to us. I've gone moved into this thing because I want to give you equanimity. I want you to have a feeling of sensitivity and yet peace about the world scene. If you don't have the right understanding of it, you can do like so many are today. Many, many people stretching themselves way out to try and get a bundle to Europe, or I mean a bundle to Ethiopia, and stretching the coffers and everything, and it lasts for a while, and then they wear themselves out. How long can you keep up carrying a burden to feed another group of people? It's even more absurd to think that the nation has the obligation to feed or to for the welfare of a people they have no control over. We have no control over the economic status of these people, and to expect that we have to nationally take the responsibility for equalizing their economic problems is absurd. But I'm bringing it down to you because I want you to carry naturally, if not always easily, but carry naturally for the long haul whatever our personal responsibility is. Now, as I said, in a way, worse than being indifferent to the world is being as caring too much and not knowing what to do about it. But also worse than not caring is being unable to regulate your response to it, and therefore to become indifferent again. You see, let us say that you're indifferent. That is not really indifferent, but not focusing. Now, all of a sudden, the focus comes in. The burden comes. You're given a great deal of pressure. Pretty soon, the burden becomes too much. Too much. Like taking care of a neighbor who has had some tragic consequence in their lives, and you take a dinner over to them and you do this and you do that. But pretty soon, as the weeks and months wear on, it becomes harder and harder to get anybody in the neighborhood to care, see? The burden becomes too much and then you drop it. I want you to have the kind of care for the world that comes from our natural, from our salvation. I think we have that. I think that Christian people in general, the moment they receive Christ, do care. Now, what to do about the caring? You have all kinds of pleas made, and you see a vast world out there that you have to help or can help. The only thing you can do is what you probably are already doing. You are doing whatever you can. People say, well, I'm not doing enough. You'll never do enough. But you do what the Spirit of Christ puts on you to do. You understand? Now, I'm doing what I can do, but I have been given certain gifts to work with, and I do what I can do with my gifts, but I don't drop this ministry to go out and try to feed the world. The fact of the matter is, as a result of this particular ministry, quite a number of people have been put back into the workforce. People from the drug crowd. People have gotten their financial position established and they're moving along all right. We have saved the government hundreds of thousands of dollars in care of people that would otherwise be in prison today. Quite a number would be in prison. It costs, according to Judge Love, my friend, it costs, I think he said somewhere around $25,000 to $30,000 a year to take care of one prisoner. Now, there are numbers that have come through to Christ and gotten out of the life of crime and are not going to be going to prison, you see. Now, this has economic side effects, you see. But I'm doing what I can carry acceptably. I take what I believe the Lord wants me to do. I don't let the rest go. But the net result, the fallout, affects quite a few people. If you feel uneasy about what you are doing personally, just pray and ask the Lord to show you what to do. Now, you girls that are seem to be just stuck in a on a dead-end street in a home, you think it's that. Some people think it's that. I don't. If you are caring for your family, the fallout of that is going to be important to the world thing. Don't worry about what somebody else is doing or what they think they ought to do or what they think you ought to do. Don't listen to them. Do what you can do. Do what you believe you can handle and not just something that's a spur of the moment. Now, I have people that say, well, how can you be so callous? Now, you know what the answer to that is? What are you doing? People talk about it, and you sound inhumane if you're not willing to talk about it. I'm saying do something, but do what the Spirit tells you to do. Now, all of this I've said going back to the feeding the 5,000, because this is personal. If Jesus had the miracle power to turn stones into bread, which he did but didn't do, Satan started him down that line. Satan started Jesus off on the line of forget about their souls, feed their bodies, make the stones into bread. Now, can you imagine how much of Jesus' energy would have been required to keep making stones into bread to feed the world? He'd have never gotten around to saving their spirits. He did not allow Satan to get him onto that treadmill. But I'm saying to you, in one stroke, God could, if he wanted to, correct the economic problems or could feed a large portion of the world by sending a little rain. God has miracles at his disposal we don't have. We have to load up a ship and send it across the water and unload it and fight the government and everything else. Or load up a plane or whatever. We humans do not have the resources to handle the world's poverty problem, even if we put all of our attention to it. God could do it easily. But it was not God's purpose to feed the world bread, but to feed the spirits. He hasn't done it. In all the centuries of human history, God has not eradicated poverty. And if he says to you, or if we think he says, that's your responsibility, then I would have to say to him, well, then give us the tools, which we don't have. Now, I don't understand it, other than the fact that God is allowing the consequences of evil to run their course. Now, if everyone who came to Christ, every fellowship, would function within their fellowship to see that they're hungry or fed and so forth, which we do in many different ways, then the believers would be cared for. I think believers anywhere would be cared for if within certain conditions. And so I'm not ignoring the idea that Christian people need to have a sense of concern for their brother, their sister, for the membership of the body. Now, if nations of people choose not to follow Christ, if individuals choose not to follow Christ, then that's their choice. Well, I'm giving you a lot of philosophical things. I don't really mean to do that. Let me draw it all together quickly here by saying that rather than talking a great game, let us rather be content to do what the Lord has given us to do and leave him with the task of handling the rest of it. I'm only trying to help you and me keep our cool about this earth and our sojourn on it by saying it is a part of the gauntlet that we run shoulder to shoulder with Christ. It has its purposes that are beyond our own understanding, and when it has been run, we will be back as Christ was to have our eternal existence with God. That way you can keep your cool. What should you do while you're on the earth in this gauntlet? Do what you believe the Lord wants you to do. If you're not in the habit of talking to him about your life, you may weave down the road in a very unstable way. If your life is in his hands, you will be doing what he wants you to do. You're not going to have to fight with him to get him to tell you what to do. You're not going to have to outguess God. You're not going to have to spend hours and hours trying to get him to tell you what to do. Our earthly ears don't hear so good anyway. But you will notice, if your life is in the Lord's hands, that he moves in your life to see that you're doing what you're supposed to do. Now, don't let any other soul on earth press you into doing something the Lord has not told you to do. And if what people are instructing you to do, do not sit peaceably with you, forget it. And the chances are the Lord's going to make it clear to you what he wants you to do in one way or the other before he's going to make it known to some neighbor or friend. If he can tell a friend what to do for what you ought to do and he can't tell you what you ought to do, that's kind of a bad scene anyway. Keep your cool. Don't make any moves one way or the other unless you have some sense within you that God wants you to make another move. See, you can always stay where you're at. So I'm not at all saying we shouldn't care. I'm saying caring comes from the Spirit of Christ in us. And he has to put the caring there. And the proper burden for us to bear comes from Christ and not from someone else. You will do more to meet the needs of the world if you will do what you are given to do and be at peace about it than if you flop around trying to find things to do that the Lord hasn't given you to do and then burn out on it and don't do anything. That so often happens. I've seen it in the church so much. Church gets hold of some new comer who's still green, and they get them into everything they can get them into, and pretty soon they get burnt out, and then they leave, and they don't do anything. See? Better to do a little that the Lord has given you and do it permanently than to do a lot for a moment and give it up.